Well, this is a parable of Jesus found only in Matthew's gospel. And Jesus is speaking here specifically to his disciples. Peter has just said, "Look, we've left everything to follow you, Jesus. What will we have?" In essence, he's asking, "What can you guarantee us? What's our payment? Promise us something that we can grasp." And to describe what is promised, the kingdom of heaven, Jesus tells a story. Now, this story is bookended with the concept of a great shuffling, a rearrangement. At the very end of chapter 19 in Matthew's gospel, these words, "The first will be last, and the last will be first." And then, at the end of the parable, you just heard it, "The last will be first, and the first will be last." So before and after the parable, there is a reminder that in the kingdom of heaven, things are going to be rearranged. There's going to be a great reshuffling.
And microphones, too. Let's try this microphone.
So this story is bookended with the concept of a great rearrangement, a great reshuffling. This phrase, "the first will be last and the last will be first," comes before the parable, and then after the parable, "the last will be first and the first will be last." Before and after this parable, there's a reminder that in the kingdom of heaven, things get rearranged. And what is fair is not the same as what is right. Now, I don't know about you, but I really like for things to be fair. I really like for things to be fair, for hard work to be rewarded, for consequences to be the exact result of what's put in, of someone's intentions, for people to get what they deserve. I like those things. They seem right to me. But in the kingdom of heaven, where God's will is in place and obeyed, not my will, but God's will, in the kingdom of heaven, there's a higher priority than what your pastor thinks is fair. That's good. That's a good thing. I one time heard Father Richard Rohr say that a parable should unlock our thinking. He was talking about the teaching of the Enneagram at the time, about this ancient spiritual teaching of the Enneagram being parabolic in nature. Nevertheless, he said that a parable unlocks our thinking. And so, really considered, a story of Jesus should always open up our minds to a new way of thinking, to a new way of seeing the world. Clarence Jordan was a farmer, and he was also a New Testament scholar. He lived in the 20th century. He died in 1969 in Georgia. He had an undergraduate degree in agriculture, and he had a doctorate in New Testament Greek. Can you imagine? Jordan wrote the Cotton Patch paraphrase of the New Testament, and he was also instrumental in founding the Habitat for Humanity. His friendship and his influence with the lives of Millard and Linda Fuller was really foundational and instrumental for them, and they went on to found Habitat for Humanity. Jordan taught that a parable of Jesus, any parable of Jesus, was like a Trojan horse. You let it in and bam, things change. That's the way a parable of Jesus should work. Our thinking just changes when we hear Jesus tell a story. One time, it is told that Clarence Jordan preached at a gilded high steeple church in Atlanta, Georgia. And after the service, the pastor asked him for some advice. The church custodian had 8 children and earned a mere $80 a week. The concerned minister had tried to get the man a raise, but had not succeeded. And so Jordan thought for a minute, and then he said, "Well, why don't you just swap salaries with the custodian? That wouldn't require any extra money in the church budget. A great reshuffling, right? The first will be last, and the last will be first. You see, I think that Clarence Jordan knew a thing or two about the kingdom of heaven. In 1942, he founded a farming community called Koinonia in rural Georgia, in Americus, Georgia, deep in the heart of the South. He envisioned this community to be committed to racial integration and nonviolence and a simplified lifestyle. He had three principles for their life together. The first was, all people are related in God's eyes. The second was, live according to Christ's love. And the third was, prioritize need over profit. Jordan believed that incarnation was the only effective means of evangelism. That must be true. That people have to see us live out what we believe to be attracted to our faith. Living out the truth of our faith, living out these three principles of all people being related in God's eyes, of living according to Christ's love, and prioritizing need over profit. We can't just speak those truths. And Jordan told the people who lived with him they couldn't just speak those truths, but they had to live them out. Well, the neighbors in rural Georgia in the 1950s, they weren't so thrilled with this social experiment called Koinonia. They much preferred their old ways of living. They much preferred racial segregation. And on the Koinonia farm, fences were cut, crops were stolen, and garbage was dumped on the property. A truck's engine on the farm was ruined by putting sugar into the gas tank. Nearly 300 fruit trees were cut to the ground. The farm's roadside market was bombed, not once, but several times. And night raiders sprayed bullets at the houses, and crosses were burnt on their lawns. All of this nonsense, this violent nonsense, forced the farm into a mail-order pecan business. Jordan said that the U.S. postal system and the pecan market were two things that the locals couldn't control. The marketing theme for Koinonia Farms during that time was, help us ship the nuts out of Georgia. I love that. And I do think that Clarence Jordan was a true follower of Jesus. He understood the link between life and death, that we don't share in the resurrection he believed and he taught and he lived out without participating in the crucifixion. He also sought the kingdom of heaven, and he endured in seeking the kingdom of heaven. His legacy lives on in Koinonia Partners, in his writings, and in Habitat for Humanity as well. All people are related in God's eyes. Live according to Christ's sacrificial love and prioritize need over profit. Matthew's gospel tells us that Jesus told a story about a landowner who hired laborers to work in his vineyard. Instead of sending a manager into the market to hire the help in the morning, the landowner goes himself. At the beginning of the day, about 6 a.m., he hires the first group for the normal amount, a day's wage, a denarian. It's a fair offer. A denarian would supply a family with 3 to 6 days of food. It's a fair wage, but it's not exorbitant. The landowner returns to the market to hire laborers at 9 a.m. and at 3 p.m. saying, I will pay you what is right. He even goes at 5 p.m. Now that is odd. He goes to the market at 5 p.m. and sends the remaining laborers into his vineyard. When evening comes, the manager finally gets involved. Call the workers, the landowner tells the manager, beginning with the last and moving to the first. Last will be first, the first will be last. And they're all paid a day's wage, a denarian. This causes those working since 6 a.m. to grumble. Because it's not fair. It's not fair. But it is right. And what is right in the kingdom of heaven? Generosity. Are you resentful because I'm generous? The landowner asks. That's verse 15, which can be literally translated this way from the Greek. Is your eye evil because I'm generous? Most of our English translations say, are you resentful or are you envious because I'm generous? But I prefer the literal translation. Is your eye evil because I'm generous? This week in my daily devotional, I found these words. The soul swims in a sea of abundance, grace, and freedom, which cannot always be organized. A sea of abundance and grace and freedom. My goodness, open my eyes to that. I want my eyes open to that. Too often, my eyes are focused on scarcity, what's wrong or what's missing, or even who has more. But my soul knows better. My soul wants better. The deepest part of me knows of abundance and grace and true freedom. May our eyes not be evil, but may our eyes be full of delight and benevolence and honor. Generosity is God's way. And I love the idea that to be created in the image of God first and foremost implies generosity. In recent years, sociologists have provided compelling evidence that generosity in its many forms, so not just financial, but generosity and charity in other ways, like charity of time or attention or even emotional energy, leads to a healthier and happier life for each of us. And theologians will tell you that when we grow in generosity, we become God's agents. We grow in generosity, and more we become God's agents. God acts through us to counteract greed and scarcity and bring forth the abundance that Jesus promised, the kingdom of heaven. There's a Haitian proverb that goes like this: God gives, but God doesn't share. God gives, but God doesn't share. The sharing's up to us. The sharing is up to you and me. Sometimes I catch a segment on television that's called Kindness 101. Maybe you've seen it, if I'm on the right channel at the right time. And this week I happen to be walking through the room with the television in it at the right time. And Kindness 101 was on, and believe it or not, the topic was generosity this week. Kindness 101 told a story about a boy who lives in Colorado named Jude. Jude's family immigrated to the United States from Ghana, and Jude is autistic, and he is also musically gifted. He has a Mozart-level gift, the story said, or you and I might say an Anthony-level gift for musical talent, coming from somewhere beyond. There was a man named Bill who also lives in Colorado, in that same town, Aurora, Colorado, and he saw a local news story about Jude and his family. And in that segment, he heard Jude play a keyboard that was located in his basement, and he learned in that news story that Jude and his parents were immigrants, or his parents were immigrants raising Jude and three other children, and sending money back to Ghana as well. Bill happens to be a piano tuner by trade, and when he heard this story, he decided to use an inheritance that he had recently received from his father to buy a $15,000 piano for Jude. Didn't know this family. A grand piano just showed up at Jude's house, came through the front door. Can you imagine? Bill tunes that piano regularly, and he also pays for piano lessons. And so Jude and his father Isaiah were asked, what do you think motivates someone like Bill to be so generous? And Isaiah, the father, said, sheer goodness. And then they were asked, has his gift to you inspired you to be more generous? And they both said, both Jude and his father said, of course, yes, definitely. Because that's what happens. We know this. When someone gives more than is expected, when we are the recipients of grace, grace doesn't stand still. It doesn't stay in one place. It keeps going. It moves through us to others. Grace is God giving away God. Grace is God giving away God for nothing, for free. It's ours for the taking. Allow that sheer goodness to fill you and to flow through you. Any time that we sit at a table with other people, I believe we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to be reminded of God's provision, of God's grace for us. And I know that this week many of us are going to sit at bountiful tables and we'll have that reminder directly in front of us that God provides well for us. So then may we in turn, as we receive this reminder of God's grace, may we in turn be agents of grace to someone else. That's generosity. And I know that we are all in need of some sheer goodness.